Yeah, well, okay. Concerning the Japanese War and all of that, some of you would know a little bit about it. There are some things that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't read a little bit of history, but they invaded Manchuria in 1931. That's a long way back there. They invaded Mongolia in 1933. That's the year I started out in the work. Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president in 1933. And it was in October of that year that I left home. Hubert and Howard went to the Philippines. They left in the fall of 1936. I was in San Francisco with Willie Richardson at the time when they left, and I had no idea I'd ever be going to the Philippine Islands, last place in the world. I didn't even hardly know where it was. I just knew it was across the Pacific. Well, then Willie Jameson went to the Philippines in 1939, and he wrote a letter back, and he said that they were needing workers over there, and he notified the workers, that Jack Carroll and Hugh Matthews and others, that they were needing workers. And so Hugh Matthews came down to see us. There were three of us boys together at down below St. Helens, Oregon, on the Columbia River. And he came down to see us and put the project before us and said if any of us were interested, why, we could volunteer to go. Well, I said, I'll go. I didn't hardly know where it was, but anyway, I volunteered. I suppose you call that going on faith. But anyway, that's when I was a young fella. Long time ago. Well, so that was in 1939, and we sailed out of San Francisco January 1940 for the Philippine Islands, and we sailed on the President Cleveland. That was Herman Bieber and I, and it was the President Cleveland was an ocean liner that carried freight and all, just like many of those ocean liners did that went to the Orient. And so I have pictures of us on the ship and on the pier before we went. Some of you have seen those pictures. And then a picture of the ship backing away from the pier and then headed out towards Golden Gate. We didn't know what all would take place before we ever came came back under that old Golden Gate again. But anyway, a lot did take place. Well, we went as far as, I tell you, I got seasick. Oh, man. You ever get seasick? I got so seasick, I didn't know. This was the worst experience I ever went through. I went to the purser and I told him I was awful sick. Actually, from straining, I vomited blood. And he just shrugged his shoulder and paid no attention to it. I guess it's not too uncommon. Well, anyway, the old ship between San Francisco and Honolulu, going this way, the ship, instead of going this way, it was going this way, the way that it was hitting the sea. It was just back and forth like that. And so there were a lot of sick people on that ship. Anyway, we got to Honolulu, and there Dave Christie and his wife were having meetings, and Herman and I spoke in their gospel meetings, and then we took off for Japan, and we hit a storm on the way to Japan. It was a real storm, and I'd gotten over my seasickness, got my sea legs pretty well by that time, and the old, in the window of the, in the dining room, the level of the porthole, it went like that, and that was lengthwise the ship. We hit a typhoon, and it knocked some of the ventilators off the ship, which had to be repaired when they went into Yokohama. But we left that ship there and stayed 3 weeks with the boys in Japan, and that was my introduction to the Orient. And in those days, Japan was an ancient, ancient, ancient city. It was different than it is today. People that go over there today have no idea what it was like in those days. Entirely different city altogether. If you can imagine a city of 11 million people without a sewage system, Well, that's pretty hard to imagine, isn't it? All sewage was carried away in open trucks and dipped out of the holes wherever they had them with big long buckets and carried down the street and dumped in the truck, and that's the way, that was a sewage system for, and there was a stench in the city that you can't imagine. And I told my companion, I don't think I could work in a country like this. And I was glad I didn't have to. Well, anyway, the Japanese were preparing for war. They were poverty-stricken. They were poor as poor could be. They didn't have enough fuel for heat. They didn't have anything. And yet they were preparing for war. And everywhere we went, the Japanese police followed us. And we had to call in at stations ever so often if we went for a walk. And there was no liberty. You could tell that everything was geared for war. And little children would run from us because they were afraid of us, foreign devils. And they were scared to death of us. But anyway, we visited 3 weeks in Japan. And the boys hadn't one convert, not one. And that was how slow the work was going in Japan those days. And they did have a meeting there and wanted us to tell them a little bit about America. And the workers there at that time, one was Sam Lang, the other was Cecil Barrett, and the other one was Ernest Stanley. They're all gone now. They're not one of them living. But Ernest had been there for 10 years and there was no work to show for it, neither, and also Sam. Cecil hadn't been there that long. But I'll tell you a little funny little incident that happened that evening. They wanted us to tell them about America, so I told them about the redwood trees and told them how big they were and what beautiful trees they were and all of this. And I never again ever told anybody about the redwood trees in the Orient. And I'll tell you why. When I got through talking about it, the workers said, good Yankee story. And I realized it was the trees were just that big that they couldn't take it in. And it's true that even we who have seen them, we have to go back and have another look at them to be sure they're that big. I remember one time there was one of the workers, Jack Forbes, came over from England. And he wanted to see the big redwood tree up there in Northern California. There's one right near the Orient Convention. So he took a piece of string with him. And he had one of us hold it, and he walked all the way around that tree. And then afterwards, he stretched it out. Now, he was from England, and he stretched it out, and it stretched out an awful long distance. And he says, they'll never believe me. That's just another good Yankee story. You understand that, don't you? Well, anyway, we took off then from there. We left Japan, and we went on the Suomaru. Now, that was a Japanese ship, and this was a new experience for me. And we went as far as Hong Kong, and we're in the meetings there with Charlie Preston and Sam Lang, and not Sam Lang, Jim, he's still alive, but he's not able to preach anymore. Jim who? Jim Gerton's a fellow a lot younger than I am. Pasco, Jim Pasco. He's been over here for conventions. He was there, and they were speaking through interpreters because they had learned the Mandarin language, and in Hong Kong they used the Cantonese. And that struck me as kind of funny, the way they went at it. They had one of these, you know, these little crickets that the kids squeezed and go pop, pop, pop. You know how they are, little metal deal. Well, They'd speak till they come to the end of their sentence, and they'd pop that thing for the interpreter to go ahead and speak. I've spoken through an interpreter, and I've interpreted lots of times, but that's the only time I ever saw that done. You generally know when a man comes to the end of his sentence, and you take over. But they did it that way, and it was quite amusing to me. Then we went on to the Philippines. We landed in the Philippines the 3rd of March, 1940, and Willie Jameson was there to meet us, and he introduced us to the friends that came down to the pier that day, and there was Hubert and Howard and Willie Jameson. Then, of course, Herman and I landed there that day. That was March 3rd, 1940. We'd left in January from San Francisco. Well, now, we got into a mission right away, Now, the boys had a mission going. Five of us worked together. That was Willie Jameson, Hubert Sylvester, Howard Yerger, and Herman and I. And Herman and I were pitching right into the language. And this was a really nice mission. We had a little tent stretched in front of the house we were living in and just had it filled up. There were more people in that meeting than there are in this meeting tonight. And out of that, we got a nice little group. Well, then we broke up, and Willie and Howard went off one direction, and Herman and Hubert and I went another direction, and that was the year that we contacted old Mr. Sarmiento. You met Simeon Sarmiento when he was over here. Well, that was his father. He professed in our meetings that year. Well, the next year, 1941, the boys returned to California, Hubert and Howard, in 1941. And about the same time I took down sick with a hepatitis, like I'd never been before, never had a hepatitis before, terribly sick. And about that time also, it was in the first part of June, that Ernest Stanley and Cecil Barrett came down to join us. They'd been advised to come down and join us to get away from Japan because it was feared that there might be war. And so they'd best, are you all hearing all right? That they'd best come down there and get away from it. So they came down to where we were. Well, now then, an interesting thing, I went to visit a man by the name of Lyle Vance. He's from Washington. I visited him. He was a Marine at that time out in Cavite. And in talking with the Marines out there, I asked them what they thought would happen if the Japanese started a war. Oh, they said, we'd lick them in 30 days. So, that was the thinking. Adrian Oldham visited us about that time, and I took Adrian down to the park and around Manila and showed different things. And got a little acquainted with Adrian. He was just a skinny kid. Younger than I was, and he didn't look to be very strong, but he's still with us. Though he turned out to be pretty tough. But anyway, by December 7th, when the war started, Cecil and Herman had moved away, down a ways in Manila there, to another place to have meetings. Now, by this time, we had about seven churches in all in the Philippine Islands. And Herman and Cecil had moved down to another place, and Willie and Ernest and I were having meetings in another area where I was. And then, on December 8th it was, we were eating breakfast, and we heard something come over the radio from the people upstairs. The landlady lived upstairs, and we lived downstairs. And the downstairs part of the house is called the silong. And that would be the part of the house that sometimes wouldn't be walled in, wouldn't be closed in at all, wouldn't be lived in. In fact, if it was out in the country, they might keep their chickens or their cow or their water buffalo there, whatever, their animals. But in some cases, they fixed it up and made living quarters. Well, this house, this was in town, and very often this was the case in town. The silong was used for living quarters, and this had been fixed up for living quarters, and we were living in that silong. Well, Mrs. Vargas lived upstairs, and we heard something over the radio, and we ate generally about 7 o'clock, I think it was. Something over the radio about an attack on Pearl Harbor, but we weren't sure just exactly what this was. So, when we'd finished breakfast, Willie said, I think I'll go upstairs and listen and see what that was. Well, the rest of us said, we'll go up with you. So we went up and asked Mrs. Vargas if we could listen to the 8 o'clock news when it came on. And when the 8 o'clock news came on, it mentioned the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all of that, but it also said that they had hit Camp John Hay in the Philippines that same morning. And the morning of the 7th in Pearl Harbor is the morning of the 8th in the Philippine Islands, because we were on the other side of the date line. You'll understand what I'm saying. It was Sunday in Honolulu. It was Monday in the Philippine Islands. And that morning they had hit Camp John Hay, and then By noon, they had hit Clark Field and destroyed. We had 50 B-17 bombers. I think that was the best bomber they had in that day. B-17 bombers, and they knocked out 49 of them and left just one. And they came, when the planes came in, the men thought that these were reinforcements, U.S. reinforcements coming in. They knew the war had started, but they thought this is U.S. reinforcements come in. And I think there were 52 Japanese bombers. I have it written down here someplace. 52 Japanese bombers came in, and they bombed the mess hall right at noon. And you can imagine what would happen in a case like that. Just simply, it was just, it was murder. Well, that's what war is anyway, I guess. Well, then, they shot down three of those bombers when they understood this is war. Well, they shot three of them down with anti-aircraft. The next day, we decided we'd better go out and see our folks that were out in Cavite. Now, I'll try and help you to understand where Cavite is. Some of you wouldn't know any more about the Philippine Islands than I did when I first went over there, so we'll just give you a little bit. This is Luzon Island. This is Manila. This is Manila Bay. And this little peninsula here, on the end of that peninsula, is Cavite City. And we had, I think, four churches in Cavite City. So we wanted to go out there and warn our people that they should get out of there, evacuate the city, because this was a military target. Sangley Point was on that in there. That was a naval base. And they had all kinds of naval stuff out there, naval base equipment and everything. And they had submarines and what have you. So we thought the best thing to do is go out and see our friends and advise them that they should get out of there, move out to the province, get away from the city. But many of them were employed in the Navy. Well, it would mean them driving back and forth. They're not driving back and forth, busing back and forth. But anyway, we went down, thought we'd go down to the main street and see if we can get a bus. Actually, I think we decided this on Monday, and we went down to the main street, and everything had been commandeered by the military. There wasn't a bus to be had. The whole thing was taken over by the military. And they already, by that time of the morning that we got down there on that first day, they had new communication lines strung up just for the military, while just big bundles of them up and down the street. That was on the main street. So we decided then on Tuesday maybe we'd better go out and see them, and we had to go by bicycle. So we went partway, and we met some of the men. They were coming in. They were coming in on bicycle because they couldn't get any transportation. And we told them what our advice was to them, that they should try to advise all the friends to get out of the city because it's going to be bombed. Well, the next thing that happened now, about, I think it was that very morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, that's on Tuesday, that's the 9th, there were zero fighters came in, and it woke us up at about 4 o'clock, and we got out there in the open to see what was going on because the whole city was awake, and there were anti-aircraft going. And what we heard at that, or what we saw at that time, the only dogfights we saw was Japanese airplanes chasing P-40s. And P-40s couldn't get out of the way of the Japanese airplane. There was no way. Those Zeros had them bested any way you look at it. There was no way that the P-40 could get out of their way. The P-40 was too heavy, and when it had turned a loop to try to come in behind them, the Zero would turn a tighter loop. And they'd come right in behind the American plane. They just shot them all down, just shot them like sitting ducks. There was nothing for them to shoot them down. All right. The next day then, this was Wednesday, 8th, 9th, 10th. The 10th of December, we were just sitting down to lunch. Just sitting down to lunch when we heard a drone, a heavy drone of airplanes, and I think it was a flight of, I'm not sure how many it was, it must have been 50 or 60 of those bombers that came over. 56 bombers, I've got written down here in my notes. 56 bombers came over, and they bombed the Manila area first, and they went out to the airport, right out to the airport, and hit the mess hall, just like they did the other, right at noon. And then they went right across the bay, which is just about 10 miles by water across there to Cavite, and they hit the naval base and bombed the commissary. They bombed Sangley Point. They bombed the radio station. They had three radio towers that, I think they said they were 700 feet high now. I don't know whether that's possible or not, but they used to build them terribly high. They had these three towers, and that was their communications in the Far East, and they knocked a couple of those towers over in the bombing, and one of our men was killed, Mr. Vasconcillo, in whose home we had a church at that time. He was the only one that was killed among our people in Cavite that day. But the paper came out, it said there were 2,200, I think it said, Filipinos killed and 100 Americans. But I think the figures could be turned around the other way because they were hitting targets that held Americans. And they were hitting these the mess halls of the military right at noon. And I'd sooner believe, and rather believe, reasonably believe, that it was 2,200 Americans. And they were trying to hide the figures so that no one would know really what had happened. And maybe a 200 Filipinos. But that would be that we're working with the Navy and for the Navy. Well, this was quite a catastrophe because they simply wiped out our Air Force right at the beginning of the war. Now, this is on Wednesday. Well, then this continues to go on. And the next morning, there came a report. One of our friends, Dale Cruz, came running down to our place. He'd come from quite a ways to tell us that the water supply was poisoned, that somehow or other had been poisoned. Well, it was a rumor. It wasn't true. But anyway, he was running to warn us all that we shouldn't drink the water, but was soon discovered that there was nothing wrong with the water. I don't know what happened, whether a lot of people drank it, and so they bore testimony to the fact it didn't hurt them. So we continued to use the water. It was all right. And there was daily bombing from then on. And I tell you what I do. I was just a young fellow. Now, it's hard for you to picture, maybe, but I was a young fellow one time. And I'd jump on my bicycle, and I'd tear out to where they'd bombed, and I'd see what kind of damage they did. And I remember one time tearing off out there, and there was a hole. It hit a house, just direct hit, and there wasn't a thing left of the house, not a solitary thing. Of course, their houses are not like our houses. It would be a house that was just about as big as from here to that pillar there, and just about square, but it was just a bamboo house with a nipa roof and bamboo floor and all that sort of thing. And these bombs, when they hit in an area that's filled soil or soft or sand, they just go right down, just bury themselves way down deep, and then blow a hole that would be 10 feet deep or 15 feet deep and just blow everything. Well, I remember going out to see this one place. I looked at that, and the hole was a deep, big hole, and then I heard a pig grunt. And right across the hole on the other side was the pig pen, and I don't know whether there'd been anybody in the house when it hit or not, but the pig was just grunting. He was hungry, and you see some funny sights. Now, one of those bombs, if it hits on the concrete, hits on a hard place, it'll explode right there, and then it just cuts grooves in the concrete every direction. And you can imagine what would happen to a person if he got hit. In fact, I saw a man down in the hospital, and he had been, you know, America sold scrap iron to the Japanese before the war. They used that scrap iron in their bombs. And it was a bent bolt, a crooked bolt, caught him in the throat. And he had the thing hanging by a chain, and he was a prisoner of the Japanese, but he was in the hospital at the time that I saw him. And There it was. That was his souvenir. But it hit him in his voice box. I don't know what kind of a voice he had. I can't remember whether he was able to talk at the time or not, but this was his souvenir of the war. Whether he ever came through the war or not, I don't know. Well, all right, we move on up a little ways. And as I said, there were these daily bombings, and I jumped on my bike and ran down there. One time I went down to the waterfront, and in the waterfront there, I'd get out. They had a concrete... I don't know what you call it, breakwater, waterfront there. And you get on that. That was on Dewey Boulevard. And I'd go out there and listen and watch. And I could watch them bomb, They were trying to bomb the American ships that were tied up to the piers, and they wanted to damage the ships, but they didn't want to damage the piers. So they tried to bomb just a wee bit short. And I remember watching the bombs go down, and then there'd be a wall of water. It just seemed like it went up and up, and then fell down again. And when it fell down, there the ships still standing there. It wasn't because the Japanese weren't good shots, but they didn't want to destroy the pier. They figured there were a lot of supplies there, which was right, and they were wanting to get the supplies. They weren't worried too much about the ships. But there's a funny thing happened there too. Now those ships that came in. Some of them were merchantmen. That's what they were. And when the war started, the day the war started, they had their men were off on shore, just like men go to shore when they get off of a ship, and they just blew the whistle. The captain blew the whistle, and they lifted anchor and left all their men on shore, and they got out of there. And those men wound up in the internment camp where we wound up later on. And I think you can understand that, all right. Well, on about the, it was about the 22nd of, this is December, about the 22nd of the month, Pedro Hernandez and Maria. We had warned the people that they should flee from Cavite and go out in the province. Well, these, for some reason or other, Pedro and Maria decided they'll go live with the workers. And they had relatives. I don't know why they didn't go to see their relatives, but it turned out it was the best thing. They came to live with us, and we just really didn't know what to do with them. We had, four of us? Let's see, there was Herman and Cecil and Ernest and Willie and myself. There were five of us. So we had five in one house, and then this old couple decided to move in on us. Well, okay. We accepted them and had them there. And then on about the 25th it was, Herman and Cecil moved back to our batch where we were. And so we all got together, all of us boys. Then on the 26th, they declared Manila an open city. And MacArthur, we didn't know where he was going, but he left the city. He left the whole thing and took his troops, and it was supposed to be very secret. But what they did, they were fleeing to Bataan. And it left the city an open city, and now this meant that it was a city without any government, any law, any rule of any kind. And if you want to see a city in chaos, why, that's the kind of a city to go to. There were gangs roaming the streets, and a person's life wasn't worth a nickel, hardly. However, I went out on the street. No one bothered me. But it was a dangerous situation. Now, if you had anything that they thought was worth anything, they're just as apt to hold you up and take it away from you. And even an American went into one of the stores there. He drove his car up front, gunpoint. He took all the goods he wanted out of a grocery store, loaded it up, figured he's going to load up and have enough for the war, and then drove off with it. That was an American. But then mob psychology is a strange thing. The Filipinos reasoned that if the Japanese had been at war with China for so many years, they were still at war with China, and they'd take anything they could get from the Chinese. So they would take everything the Chinese had, so we might as well have it. Can you understand that psychology? And it was the Chinese that are the businessmen over there, and they own all the stores. And so on the street, like for instance on the street called Libertad, there in Pasay, for three or four blocks, every store is Chinese. And I went down there and watched them loot those stores. And there wasn't a thing you could do. It was just mob psychology. And they just going into there, just mob. The street was just mobs in the street. And they go in there and just charge into those stores and grab an armload and then rush out through the crowd. And as they're going out, the fellas grabbing at the stuff they had just like a football player. They're trying to grab it what they had. Well, so this is the way that it went. And I watched one store there. I remember this one in particular. The old Chinese fella, he just didn't know what to do. He was just at his wit's end. So he went upstairs, and I was standing across the street, and you could watch. Over there, they generally their store fronts are open, and the living quarters are open upstairs where they would live. And there he was upstairs, and you could see his mosquito net, which would be stretched over his bed. And upstairs he had a lot of supplies up there that he would use in his store also. And pretty quick, up the stairs they came, just by force, a whole mob of them. And they began to grab and stuff, and they didn't even want the stuff. They didn't even want it, but they're throwing it out the window and people catching it outside. And I remember this was, it was just kind of funny, because they got a whole couple of cases of toilet tissue, and they're just throwing them out in the crowd catching them and getting this. And it wasn't a matter of them getting it because they needed it or wanted it. It was just mob psychology. And just go in there and throw everything out. And they just cleaned those stores out, one after the other, one after the other, all right on down the street. Now, if you can imagine what mob psychology does, why, that's just a little picture of it. And I just felt terrible about it. In fact, I told everybody on the street, I said, it is a terrible thing for people to act like this. But I couldn't change that. I couldn't change their minds any. Well, okay. That happened when MacArthur left the city. Well, then on the 28th, this was Sunday, Herman and I, we had our meetings over there at 9 o'clock, our little Sunday morning meetings. And this Sunday, we had been told that Americans should report to the Polo Club to be warned as to what should happen and what they should do when the Japanese came in. So Herman and I went. This wasn't very far from where our Sunday morning meeting was, so it was at 8 o'clock. And we went over there. Now, this was the warning that they gave. They said, when the Japanese come in, they said, now, don't surrender right away. Stay hid as long as you possibly can. Don't surrender immediately. Stay hid as long as you possibly can. Because the longer it is, the more time they have to cool off. If they come in fighting, and they're in a mean temper when they come in, well, they just kill everybody they meet. So you stay hid as long as you possibly can. Don't surrender. And this was their advice. And they said to just be very careful what we did. Well, then, so we went to the meeting after that. That was at 9 o'clock. We got into the meeting, and afterwards we told the other boys what we had heard that morning. Well, Cecil and Ernest were dubious about any of this sort of thing. They didn't think that this amounted to a thing. They were in Japan, and they had been among Japanese people, and they were completely, what should I say, brainwashed by Japanese psychology, and they thought the Japanese people were just the most wonderful people. And all these stories of atrocities, that was just hogwash. And it was nothing but American propaganda, and Japanese don't act that way. They don't do those things. And Ernest was just absolutely, he just upset him terribly to hear these stories. This is just a lot of tommy rot. It doesn't amount to thing. It's not true. The Japanese don't act that way. So we had a kind of a, it was a little bit difficulty called that way. But anyway, now, on the 31st, this was Wednesday, the 31st, I decided that I wanted to see our folks one more time before the Japanese came in. Just this one more time, I wanted to see them. And that would be the people out in Cavite Province. And they were supposed to have evacuated out into some of those towns out there. There were different towns that they could evacuate into. And one of them would be Malabon, and another would be Henro Trias. And so I set out to go out there. Now, I wanted some of the other boys to go with me, and they wouldn't go. So I said, well, I'll go by myself. So, all right, I headed out there. Well, I had to go past the airport. Now, we knew that the entrance of the Japanese was imminent. We didn't know when they were coming, but we knew it was dangerous, and I didn't want to be caught away from the batch. So I got on my bike, and I started out, and went past the airport. And this airport area had just been carpet bombed to where there wasn't anything left. The civilian population had just been bombed out, been wiped out completely. And there were people out there trying to pick up the remains of their relatives and whatever they could find, handkerchiefs around their face so as the stench wouldn't bother them too bad. And then there were some funny sides to this. You know, those bombs I mentioned, when they hit on pavement, well, what they do, they'll push that pavement down. The explosion pushes the pavement down, evidently. But sometimes don't break the pavement too bad. It just goes down like that and then up again. And what I mean down, that might be a place that's 8-10 foot wide. But it makes a big dip. And a car passed me, Filipino driving, and he went by me and this fellow was just like I was. He was looking both ways and seeing everything that he could see with his eyes while he was going down the road. And there was one of these holes in front of him. And it was kind of comical, you know. He come to this hole, and his car just squatted down in that hole, and then it jumped out on the other side. Well, you know, I'd have given anything to have been out in front and just see what the expression was on his face. I'm sure he thought he was got. But anyway, I went on then. I come out to the Parañaque Bridge, and when I got out to the Parañaque Bridge, they were mining it. And boy, this one didn't look good to me, and I tried to pump those guys. I tried to get information to get them to tell me when they were going to blow the bridge up and what they were going to do. I told them I wanted to get back. I didn't want to get caught out there. They wouldn't tell me a solitary thing. They didn't breathe a word. Well, I decided I'll just take my chance. So I went out across the Parañaque Bridge. Then I went out. I was going out to a place about 20 miles away. And then I come to the Binakayan Bridge, and the Binakayan Bridge was just about a block long. It was a long bridge and deep water. And here these guys were mining this bridge. So I went and talked to them. I told them, I said, I want to get back across here and I don't want to get caught. Well, the fellow finally told me, he says, I'll tell you what. He says, we've got orders to mine the bridge, but he says, we don't have any orders to blow it up. But, he says, if they give us orders to blow it up, we blow it up. He says, we don't have any, we can't tell anybody when that's going to be. We don't know a thing about it. Well, I said, I'll have to take my chances. So, all right, I took my chances. I wanted to see our friends and see them one more time, as many of them as I could, before the Japanese came in. So I went on my bicycle right on out there to that area, and I didn't know where any of them lived because they weren't going to be in their own houses. They'd evacuated out of the town of Cavite, and so I ride up and down the street. So I was riding down the street here and saw somebody I knew. So, all right. I asked them if they knew where the rest of the folks were, any of them around there. Yeah, he said. Well, I says, could we get them all together and have a meeting? He says, sure. So, got them all together. And this was, I got there, well, I think it was just maybe a little after noon or about noon. I don't remember a noon meal that day at all. But anyway, gathered the friends together, and we had a meeting. Well, you know, there was no laughter in that meeting. I was a pretty serious fella, and they were pretty serious. And we were talking pretty seriously. And we knew we weren't going to see one another for a long while. And we didn't know what was going to happen, but I was trying to encourage them as much as I could in the situation, so that's what I was doing there. And then, afterwards, I told them, now, I told them what the situation is. They were mining those bridges, and I've got to get back before they blow them up. And I don't know if they're going to blow them up or what, but I said, I've got to get back before they do that. Now, the thing was that if they needed to delay the advance of the Japanese, they'd blow them up. Well, I didn't know a thing about the advance of the Japanese, but I started back down towards home, and I just went down there just as fast as that old bicycle would go, just as fast as it'd go. I took it down that, of course, I was young. And finally, I come down to the Binakayan Bridge, and boy, it was still there. Boy, I was sure glad that bridge was there. And I went across that bridge, and I never slowed up. I just kept right on going. I still had the Parañaque Bridge to go over. And I went tearing down there as fast as I could go down to that Parañaque Bridge. I must have been sweating like a horse. I don't know. But anyway, I went right on down to the Parañaque Bridge. When I got there, it was there. They hadn't blown it up. They got it mined, everything set, but they hadn't blown it up. Well, then I come back to the airport. And that was kind of interesting there at the airport. I'll tell you what. The bridge going out to the airport, there's a kind of a slough in front of the airport between it and the highway, and there are houses in between that too, and then the slough, and then there was a bridge going over the slough, and the bridge, I would say, was about 8 or 10 feet at the crown of the bridge, higher than the ground around about, and all the houses had been bombed, so you had a clear sight of everything. You could see everything on the airport. Well, I pulled up there, and it was a heart-rending sight to see. They were burning and destroying everything on the airport property that they could destroy that the Japanese could use. And so I watched them, and right while I stood there, they had mined the runway by taking and putting dynamite in one of the culverts that run all the way under the airport, under that runway, and they must have put tons of dynamite in there, just tons of it. I suppose they did. They couldn't haul it away with them, so they put it in there. And they blew it right while I was there. And it piled a pile of dirt, I suppose, 5 or 6 feet high on both sides of that trench. But that wouldn't stop the Japanese very long. That's not much of a deal. Then I watched them while they run a couple of tankers out there, and they opened the spigot. I don't know how far back they'd opened the spigot. They opened the spigot, and then they run way back and lit it, and then the fire just went right down to the tanker, and these burned up right on the runway. One of the interesting things was that one of those tanks, when it burned, it blew up finally, and that old tank it blew off the truck, and it just went up in the air, just turning over and over and over and up and up and up and up, and then finally come back down, landed pretty much in the vicinity of where the truck sat. But anyway, it was scorched earth policy, and they were just destroying everything. It just made you sick at heart to see them doing that. You know, well, very well, the Americans are leaving us. We knew this, of course, they already knew this, but they're leaving us, and everything is being destroyed. Well, so I went back to the batch that day feeling pretty glum. But anyway, I saw things that my partners didn't see. They didn't get out there to have a look at all that. Well, now then, within a month after the war started, we were in a prison camp. But now let me tell you how all this happened. We got the warning that we shouldn't give ourselves up. We shouldn't surrender. Well, there was an old man that was sick. His name was Mr. Funk, and some of you, if you're any of you acquainted up around the San Jose area, some of you would know, be acquainted with Ruth Berry. You knew Ruth and Sam. Well, she was a girl, 16, 18 years old at that time, and it was her father that was dying. He was an American. Her mother was Filipina. But he died on the 2nd, and I think it was, in my mind, it's the 3rd when the Japanese come in. And I went back and told the boys that he had died, and they had to come across the main street, but went across, watched up and down the street to see if there were no Japanese, and then got across the street. And the Japanese came in total victory. There was no opposition. They just come in with flags flying and just drove right down the street, never stopped for anything. They were in charge because it was a vacated city. Well, the boys went back across there, and they had a service for the old man, and I stayed at the batch while they had that, and they would like to have had us go out to the airport, our airport, out to the cemetery, but we couldn't go out to the cemetery. There was no way, because we had to stay hid. We had to stay out of where we'd be seen. So we told them that they would have to go to the cemetery by themselves and bury old Mr. Funk. Old Mr. Funk, he never professed. He wasn't one of our friends, he had said that the Japanese weren't going to get him. He'd shoot them when they come. He was going to be ready, and he'd shoot. He wasn't going to take him no prisoner. Well, he died of cancer, and he died the day before the Japanese came in. Well, then, on that was the 6th of January. This is 1942 now. And it's less than a month after the war started. And the Japanese now had been putting prisoners in what was called Villamore Hall down on the university campus. The rumors came out that this was the way that it worked, that they put them in Villamore Hall. And this was an old, old university auditorium and would hold a lot of people. But it had no toilet facilities, it had no water, it had no nothing. And they just chucked the Americans in there and put a guard at the door, and old or young, it didn't make any difference, and they just chucked them into that Villamore Hall, and that was it. One old man told me how he was picked up. His name was Little, old Mr. Little. And he was married to a Filipino woman, well, being an American, why the Japanese picked him up. And he was a skinny, poor old fella. And when the Japanese came to his house, they saw what kind of a fella he was. And they had a 6x6 truck. Well, a couple of the Japanese just grabbed a hold of his feet, and another one grabbed a hold of his hands, and they just took him and swung him 2 or 3 times, swung him up over the truck, and bang, he landed on the floor of the truck inside. But he survived. But some people died in that Villamore Hall there. And we'd heard rumors of all this, but Ernest was sure that all this was just a lot of American propaganda, and there was nothing to it. Well, we were fortunate in a way, but here's what happened. On the 6th, Ernest decided he was going for a walk. So he went for a walk. Now, Ernest could speak Japanese perfectly, absolutely perfectly. And he was an artist with the language. Well, he went for a walk, and there was some Japanese coming down the street in a car. So he waved at them. They stopped. And he says, "We're some Europeans and Americans over here, and we want to surrender." And so here at 5:30 in the evening, why, he come driving up in a little car, just like some little car you'd have here today. And there were already two Japanese in the car, and there were five of us. So you can imagine, that'd be pretty tight squeeze. Well, the Japanese told us that we weren't to take anything with us. You don't need to take anything with us. They're just picking us up. And he said, "We'll take you down to register you." And these Japanese really didn't know one thing about it. So they took us down, and they took us to Rizal Stadium. They didn't know where there was an internment camp. They took us to Rizal Stadium, and that wasn't an internment camp. Took us to another place, and that wasn't an internment camp. And finally, they got the idea that maybe it was Villamore Hall. So they took us down to Villamore Hall. Somebody had told them. I suppose some Japanese told him it was Villamore Hall. So we went down to Villamore Hall. There was a guard there, and he talked a little bit with the guard. The Japanese talked a little bit with the guard, and of course Ernest understood every word that was said, and Cecil understood most of it because he was not too bad in Japanese. And then we drove off. Didn't know what the deal was. But it just happened that they'd moved all the people out of Villamore Hall that day and put them in Santo Tomas University. So we were among those that went into the Santo Tomas University on the first day that it was open for internees. That would hold several thousand because it was a big university. It was about two or three blocks one way and two or three blocks the other way. Had a high hollow block concrete wall around three sides of it and an iron grill fence across the front of it. And the iron grill fence had, slots maybe that wide, and it was probably so high. Well, anyway, that's where they took us. And we got in there about 6. And then we stood around in the halls of that old university till midnight. They were going to assign us, tell us we had to wait until we were assigned to rooms. So we stood around there till about midnight. Then there were about 600 of us men that they put in some little school buildings that were the practice teaching buildings for the school teachers that were learning to teach out behind the university there in a space. There were just one-story buildings. And they were filled with little desks for children, you know, Filipino children, not American children, little Filipino children. And here we were 600 men trying to make ourselves comfortable in a place like that. And the desks were too little for us to sit in, and the floor and the desks and everything was full of bed bugs, and there were no screens on the windows, and so we had mosquitoes and bed bugs and everything galore. The next day, they took us and put us in the gymnasium, 600 of us men, and that was on a concrete floor. But that was better than the other place anyway. There wouldn't be the bed bugs on a concrete floor. It was like a basketball court, that sort of thing. And then, my investigating, I noticed that people were going out to the front grill fence that was across the front, and Filipinos who were their contacts came with their... they could contact these Filipinos, and they would bring supplies to them. That is, Filipinos that worked for them. They were their houseboys and housegirls, and they came down there, and whatever they wanted, they'd bring it. Well, I just says, our friends will bring things too. We haven't got a thing. One of the boys had grabbed a dozen or 15 cans of, I think it was beans, pork and beans or something like that we had there at the batch, brought that along. Well, that helped out. We didn't have spoons or knives or forks or dishes or anything. And the Japanese didn't bother feeding us. It was just every man for himself. And that's the way that they ran their prison until the Americans used up all their resources. For the first 6 months, the Japanese didn't feed the prisoners. Then after that time, the Japanese began to come in taking care of the needs of the camp because... they had used up all the resources. Now, this is the way that Romans used to run their prison camps and prisons in olden days. It was up to the person that was in prison to take care of himself. If he didn't have any relatives, if he didn't have any friends, he could just as well starve to death there in prison because they didn't care much for them. Well, so I saw what was going on. I got right out there at that grill fence. And I says, that's where I'm going to station myself, and I'm going to see. Some of our friends will come along. Well, sure enough, some of our friends came along. And when they did come along, why, there I was out at the fence. And they want to know what we need. First of all, they came. They brought a lot of stuff. And the folks that had come to our batch to stay with us, this was the fortunate part. When we were picked up and taken away, there they stayed in the batch. And they held it together, and no one could come in and take things. They were watching the batch. And so they came down there, the old Pedro, he came down. He was an old man. But he came down there and asked us what we needed. And we told him so. They brought our mosquito nets. We didn't have any mosquito nets. We didn't have a blanket. We didn't have a pillow. We didn't have a solitary thing. Just us. That's all we had. So they brought these things along. I'm taking a lot of time on this, haven't I?
You ain't going nowhere.
You're not going nowhere? Well, anyway, the next thing then, they decided that they'd put a rope across that section out there by the fence, and only certain ones could act as porters, carrying stuff in and out. Well, I said, I'll be a porter. So I got right in there, and I was right in there so that I could help out. And our people did come. They came out to the fence there, and we'd tell them what we needed, and they brought the stuff we needed, and so we were getting along not too bad. Well, then about the, you see, we went in on the 6th. Well, then there were rumors that they were going to take all the missionaries and move them out and put them into another camp. And I thought, oh, my, that'd be a terrible thing. I'll tell you why I thought that'd be a terrible thing. There was a hallway in this gymnasium where us men were sleeping. There was a hallway, and it went back to the restrooms and showers and all that. There would be two hallways, one that the women would use in normal times, you know what I mean? Now it's all men. But there would be the restrooms back there. Well, there was an old guy. He used to sit in the hallway there, and he was a missionary, and he'd have his glasses down on his nose, something like this, you know. And then he'd have his Bible sitting on his knee, and everybody that come down there, that come into that, that was going back to the restroom, well, he'd just size them up while they're going by. And here he's so holy you couldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole, you know. I thought, man alive, be separated into a camp where they're all missionaries and they're that kind of guys? I don't want to go to a camp like that. Well, on the 14th, we got the order that all missionaries were to be ready to move the next morning at 10 o'clock. We didn't know what this meant. But anyway, they lectured us all day long. Lectured us, that's on the 15th, they lectured us all day long. And finally, it turns out, at about 4:30, that they're going to send us back to our batch where we'd come from. And we had to, what they were telling us all this time was, you've got to obey the laws, you've got to do what you're told, you've got to be subject to the Japanese rule and order and everything. And then it finally comes out this way, that we're going to turn you loose in the city of Manila, and you're going to live in your batch or your house, wherever it was, and you're going to consider yourself interned in your own homes, and you're not to leave your homes except to buy food or clothing or medicine or see a doctor. Otherwise, you're not to leave. Well, most of these religious outfits, they had 40, 50, 60 people in their outfit, and they had compounds, and their missionaries lived in that compound. Well, that made just a good internment camp. They could put a Japanese at the gate, and they had to toe the line. Well, we were only four men, because Ernest, he decided he'd stay in that camp and be interpreter in the camp. So we were only four men. Cecil and Herman and Willie and I went back to the batch. And they couldn't be bothered putting a Japanese to watch four men. So I tell you, we had liberty, and then we took liberty. If you can imagine. Well, this is the way it went. But anyway, Bataan then, let me see, Bataan fell. It was the first part of April. And then Corregidor fell the first part of May. And then These soldiers, you remember the death march? You've heard of the death march. They started that when Bataan fell. There were 25,000 soldiers died in the death march. 25,000 soldiers died in the death march. Now, you wonder what caused them to die? I'll tell you what caused them to die. The Japanese wouldn't give them water, wouldn't give them anything to drink. They kept them marching steadily, sun or no sun, and night or day, and they would relieve the Japanese soldiers that were marching them, and they wouldn't relieve the fellows that were marching. They wouldn't relieve the Americans. And they were so famished for water that they were just crazy for water. Well, they have these water buffalo over there that they use to work in their fields. One thing for the health of the water buffalo, he has to have water to lay in. That's part of his health. Doesn't have enough hair on him to keep the flies off him, and even when he's in the water like that, he'll just have just his nose sticking out in his eyes and his ears, and then the flies get to bothering his nose, and he just dunks it under, and then he comes up again, and that's the way they rest, and they rest and they sleep in the water. Well, they'd come to one of these water buffalo wallows, Kalabau wallows, we call them Kalabau, and they'd come to one of these places. And the men would just, now the threat was that if they broke ranks, they'd shoot them. Well, they did. A lot of them got shot. And a lot of them got killed with bayonets. But they were just crazy for water. And they'd break ranks and go and drink that filthy, filthy, filthy water. Well, that's where this plague of bacillary dysentery got started. And 25,000 of them died before they reached camp. And about this same time, I got the bacillary dysentery. And I was with the boys, and we were free in the city, but I knew I got it, and I got it on a Wednesday, and I don't know just exactly what date that was, but it was on a Wednesday, and when I got it, I knew I'd gotten it. I knew I had it. I was sure could be. There was no two ways about it. And I told the boys, I says, I've got the bacillary dysentery, and I says, I know I've got it. Well, there was a doctor lived right across the street from us, Dr. Pablo. Well, they went over and got the doctor and brought him over. Well, he looked at me, and I wasn't that bad yet. But I knew what was happening. I had a terrible diarrhea that goes with it. And just all the liquid was going right out of me. That's all there was to it, just draining it right out. Oh, the doctor came over and looked at me. No, he's just a little upset stomach, he thought. Well, you died in 3 days, about 3 days with that. And this was Wednesday. All right, Thursday I was sick, and on Friday I knew that I had it. If they don't do something for me, I'm done. Well, they got Dr. Pablo to come over again, and he just took one look at me, and he saw the difference. He could see. And he gave me 7 sulfathiazole tablets. Those 7 sulfathiazole tablets saved my life. That night, I was delirious all night. Herman Bieber took care of me, and it must have been quite a job. I didn't know how many times I went to the bathroom, but he told me afterwards that he took me 17 times that night. I was delirious, didn't know it. But the next day, my temperature was gone, and I was so to speak, in a sense, all right. But I was so weak, the thing had hit me so hard, that I was just, I had no strength at all. I had no strength, absolutely no strength. And that same morning, a Red Cross nurse came to our door, and how or why, I don't know. But she inquired about us, and they told her I was sick. Well, it was bacillary dysentery I had, and this is considered very contagious. So she took me in a car, and where she got the car, I don't know. She was a Red Cross nurse. The first one we'd seen, I think maybe the last one we saw. But she took me then, and she took me down to a certain hospital, and they wouldn't take me in there because this is a contagious disease. She took me to another hospital, Manila Sanitarium. They wouldn't have me there. She took me to the Philippine General. They wouldn't have me there. And then, finally, she took me down to San Lazaro Hospital. That was the pest house where they kept everything, including lepers and everything else. And they took me into an area where these were 50-man wards, and each ward had 2 toilets. 50-man wards, and these wards were filled with men that had run away from Bataan. The Filipinos got into civilian clothes, and then the Japanese couldn't catch them. They'd get away. They'd get rid of their war clothes. But they had this dysentery. Same thing had happened to them as happened to the Americans. And they came into the hospital there, 150 men in a 50-man ward. Now, if you can just get the picture, I tell you, it was terrible. But that's where they took me and dumped me there. Well, the boys came down to see me two or three times, but I tell you, this was no vacation place. And from the time I got in there, I was begging to get out. I wanted to get out. If it was possible, I wanted to get out. And finally, the Japanese, or the hospital attendants didn't want to let me out. They were afraid of the Japanese because they said, if we turn you loose, why, we'll get in trouble with the Japanese. Well, I told them I came in here on my own. I said, the Japanese didn't bring me. Well, finally, they began checking records, and they found out that the Japanese didn't bring me. So, all right, then they turned me loose. Well, I thought I was strong enough to walk back out to where the boys were, but I had to cross clear across Manila, a city of almost 1 million people. And I walk a little ways, and then I'd sit down on the curb. Now I walk a little further. I suppose I left the hospital there about 9:30 or 10 o'clock. I walk a little further, and I'd sit down. I walk a little further and sit down. And I kept walking and sitting down, walking and sitting down. Finally, I came in about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I got into the batch there. The boys were surprised to see me. But anyway, I got out of that terrible pest house. I sure wasn't enjoying my time in that place. And then we hadn't been there too long. You know, I had bought now 30 days. We heard the war was supposed to last 30 days. So I went down. We like this tomato sauce, you know, these little cans of tomato sauce. We liked that on our rice. It worked real well. Willie liked it, and I liked it. We all liked it. So I went down and bought 30 cans. Well, you can understand about how long that lasted us. But I went down, and I also, and Willie thought that was awful foolish, but I went down and bought four or five five-gallon cans of kerosene. Then I took them and buried them out behind the house. Willie thought that was awful foolish for me to buy that kerosene. But I tell you, that kerosene went a long ways. If I hadn't have bought it, well, we wouldn't have had anything for a long time to cook our food with. Well, then we got the idea that if we were living in a different place where we could have a garden, it would be beneficial. So there was an old Mrs. De Jesus, and she said we could live in her house, in the upstairs, if we wanted to, and her relatives were living downstairs, not in what you call the silong, but up off the ground above. It was an American-style house because her father had been an American, and he'd built this house, and said, we could live upstairs. So, okay, this had a big, big yard, and no one doing anything with it. So we moved, and we began to farm that yard, and Willie was the main farmer. He just worked on that continually to get things growing. Herman carried it to the market and sold it or traded it, and I was the cook, and that's the way it worked. And I was so weak and so from this bacillary dysentery, I couldn't get my strength, and I'll tell you what happened to me. I got what they call the sprue. Sprue is not a disease, it's a condition. It's a condition of being so weak that you can't digest your food, and because you can't digest it, you get what you might call a yeast formation in your stomach, and everything you eat just sours, and that's all there is to it. So I had a diarrhea for a year after that, and I was losing weight continually, until finally one day there was a Filipino came to our house, and he looked at me and he said, you're sick. I said, yes, I'm sick, and he wondered what's wrong with you. Well, I told him. Oh, he says, you know what we do for that? He says, we eat charcoal. Well, it made sense to me. I knew that they used to feed charcoal to pigs to get kill diseases and things like that with pigs, and also with chickens. And I had used it for chickens myself. And when the chickens got worms and wouldn't lay eggs, well, you just take and put this in their mash, put charcoal in their mash, mix it up with it so they can't separate it. And in a few days, why, they're back laying eggs again. The worms are all gone. You killed them off. And that's the way it just worked wonders. Well, I thought, well, maybe this is it. Well, I started eating charcoal. And you know what? I up till that time, I was down to 120 pounds, and my belt was out about 3 or 4 notches past what it is now. My stomach would be fully gassed. That's just the way it was. And the charcoal absorbs the gas. They say it'll absorb 50 times its cubic measure in gas. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. But it also kills the acidity in the stomach and makes it so that you can digest your food. Well, I got back to digesting my food, and then in a year's time, I gained back my weight. But now then, we can't jump up that far too quickly.